Welcome to Shazam, the podcast that hopes to make itself obsolete. I'm your host, Kayla Drescher. What does it take to be a good street performer? Well, these two Boston roomies have lots of advice, and it begins in 3, 2, 1. Happy Thanksgiving week, everyone. I hope you have great plans for Thanksgiving, even though it'll probably be over Zoom or something weird. I am really excited. We have these two friends. All of us have gotten COVID tests, and we're going to be having a giant vegan Thanksgiving feast in their backyard. So fingers crossed anyway that that continues to be the plan and happens, because Los Angeles is creeping up closer and closer to a curfew and a lockdown and all this stuff. COVID's getting pretty rough in California, like rough, even worse than it's been so far. So we are hoping that Thanksgiving plans continue, but also at the same time, if we go on a lockdown, at least it's for a good reason, because we need to nip this COVID thing in the bud. I'm over it. I realize I've said that a lot. I realize we're all over it way more than I am. So hopefully we have a great Thanksgiving week, and I hope you eat a lot of food and take a really big nap. That is my utmost hope for you. Anyway, this episode is so awesome. I first met our two guests when I had the opportunity to perform for the virtual version of the Boston Magic Lab, which you'll hear about a little bit in the show. It's this really cool open mic style show for performers, all around the idea of giving a safe place to try out new stuff and to receive feedback. It's rare that I do a show where then afterwards there's a scheduled feedback session and everyone cares enough to give you their honest thoughts and then also take the criticism. And this group of performers is really, really dedicated to making not only their magic better, but making all magic better. So it was really fun and such an honor to perform. So Felice is the founder of the Boston Magic Lab show, and Kate was the host of that show. And so it was really awesome to get to know them a little bit. And immediately after, there was no question that they both needed to be on an episode of Shazam. It was such an honor to get to talk to them at length about what they both do, which is primarily street performing. This is a skill that I do not possess and most other people do not possess. It takes a very special kind of human, in my opinion, in order to be good at street performing and doing a really good show and learning how to actually make a living at it. And this episode is going to give you a lot of great advice on how to be a good street performer, amongst a lot of other really interesting things. So here's a little bit about our two guests. Kate Great has been performing in circuses, on stages, and streets around the world for almost 20 years. She's been performing her own solo comedy street show, The Kate Great Show, since 2009. She's performed in 11 different countries. She has a minor in theater from Florida State University and is a graduate of the Quebec City Circus School. Felice Ling is a social scientist, a Boston-based magician, and an international street performer. She's performed in festivals and on the streets of three different continents, but spent most of her pre-pandemic time performing in Boston's Faneuil Hall, which, by the way, as you'll hear about in this episode, is a really hard gig to get. She's also the founder of the Boston Magic Lab, which I mentioned, a monthly open mic magic show that just celebrated its 1 year anniversary. And if you haven't already, check out the Boston Magic Lab show, which is now virtual during the pandemic. It's really, really awesome. Link is in the show notes. So let's get to it. Please welcome Kate Great and Felice Ling.
Hi, Kate. Hi, Felice.
Hi. Hey.
I'm so excited that you're both here. This is awesome. This is super, super great. What people might not know by listening to this is that you're roommates. I wanted to have you both on as guests, but then when I realized you were roommates, I was like, this is an episode, which is so cool. So how did the two of you meet, which then eventually became to let's share a home?
On the street.
Yeah. Police
came up and said hi.
I moved to Boston in 2012 and started doing street shows at the world famous Among Street Performers, Faneuil Hall. I was doing shows and then Felice shows up and she's interested in street performing. And I was like, another woman on the pitch. Oh my God, let's be friends. And then we were like, we started working at Harvard Square together. And then eventually I had a spot open up in my apartment. And then I basically convinced Felice that she should take that spot. And she did.
That's such a great story. Okay, so you mentioned Faneuil Hall. I lived in Boston for a while. I went to school there. I love Faneuil Hall. It used to be a regular college activity of mine to go there, get a snack, and see a street show, which was awesome. Can you, though, explain to people who don't know what that is? And it's also very, from my understanding, please correct me if I'm wrong, but it's like a coveted thing for street performers, right? It's not easy to do a show there. You can't just walk up and go, here we go. You have to actually fight for it. So can you explain to everybody what it is and how do you even get into doing a show there?
First, we'll start with street performing. Where you do a street show is called a pitch. That's the spot that you do if your listeners aren't familiar. Mm-hmm. And there are a bunch of different types of systems for pitches. There is what you call a lineup, there's what you call a draw, and then there's also what's called a closed pitch or an audition spot. So our spot is like on public land, but it's privately managed. So there's actually an audition process to get into Faneuil Hall and become a street performer there. And then our program is centrally managed as opposed to every busker showing up every single day to get a spot. We schedule about a month out and we're really lucky that we actually get to work with some of the top acts that are on the festival circuit today. Every busker festival that I go to, I usually am working with at least one other Faneuil Hall performer, sometimes two or three. So just coming here in terms of career development, just to be in an environment where I'm working with some of the top shows has been really, really good for me.
We have a listener question on this topic, actually, from Rob Belchunas, who will ask a question in every single episode, wants to know, what's your favorite place to perform in Faneuil Hall? Because there's lots of different pitches. So where's your favorite place to do a show?
So the pitches for the circle performers, so that's Kate and the Big Variety Acts, they have two big spots. And their magic pitches, there's one main magic pitch. There's a lot fewer magicians there. It's me, Magic Zach Evans, Darren Young, Malik. So there's four of us. And there's really one pitch for us right now. And then there's another spot that used to be a musician spot, but the vendors there didn't like music. So now it's a magic spot, except it's not because there's no performances anymore. But the one that I like is that spot that's between the two big shows.
Ah, okay.
There are different kinds of street shows that happen just like in general in the world. The three different kinds of shows you usually see are circle shows, and that's the kind of show where a performer will stand in the center and gather a large crowd around them that forms a circle.
There are magicians who do that.
It's true.
I'm not one of them, but there are magicians who do that.
Okay.
So yeah, you form a circle, you do the whole show, and then at the end, people come forward and pay you. Then what Felice does more is a sidewalk show where her strategy, instead of doing one or two big shows a day or three big shows a day, she will take her time and do more smaller shows to like a half horseshoe. So the audience comes and goes more quickly and you can do more shows.
Mm-hmm.
And the next one is a walk-by show, which is basically the people walk by and give you money. So you're doing something interesting, like did you get that?
Walk by.
They walk by. So like a musician, people will walk by a musician and they'll give them a few dollars, or like a juggler will just be standing there juggling and not being engaging individually. And the audience will be like, oh, it was very good. You seem like you practice a lot. Good for you.
Is that living statues as well?
Yes.
Got it. Listen, you don't need to explain any of this to me because I am also a very well-practiced street performer. I did two shows. And
a veteran.
In Frog Pond. I don't know anything about street performing. I was so bad. I made $0. So it's great.
It's very hard. Do not feel bad about yourself.
I quit so fast. I was like, I have no confidence. So you've broken down the three main types of street shows. What is a good street show? How do you even start? There's so much information here and I don't even know where to start because I actually don't know what I'm talking about.
Before I give the real answer to your question, I'm going to do an anecdote. I actually went out to street perform for the first time I think in like 2005 or 2006, and I was living in Colorado performing at Pearl Street Market. I was a circus performer. I had already been circus performing for like 5 or 6 years, and I went out and I thought I could do a show, and I could not. I made like $5 and I was doing backflips and stuff. Like it was awful. It was both humiliating and also humiliating. I thought there was going to be two things to that list, but that was basically, it was very dispiriting. And I tried twice more and never made more than like $20 or $30 and quit for a year because I had only done street performing because I was looking for money and I thought it would be easy. And I was so very wrong. Meanwhile, Felice, when she's talking about her origin story, went out randomly and just invented street performing by herself. She was like, I think this is how it works. And then it did. And she did it. And she didn't quit. And to me, that's pretty amazing.
What's a resource? How do you learn how to put together a street show? Is it literally just trial and error? Or is there a community or books and stuff that you can be like, oh, that's how I do it?
My first source was a Gazo DVD. I wanted to understand and learn about the format of a street show. So I was watching Gazo's DVD, not to learn cups and balls, but to understand street. And then I guess after that, because there weren't any street performers in Memphis, I kind of made it up as I went. Then in Chicago, I think a lot of it is learning from others. So in Chicago, I watched, there's a street magician there, Jeremy, the magician from Britain. That's his real name. And there were break dancers there. There was a living statue there that I learned a lot from. And then in Boston, completely brand new ball game where I was able to meet a lot more other street performers. And I think that was when I started to really understand more. I learned a lot in Chicago, but just a completely different format of a show in Boston. And then also, before I went to Faneuil Hall, I was in Harvard Square for a long time. Because of the closed nature of Faneuil Hall, yet to audition, I didn't feel confident enough to audition for maybe 2-3 years. Even though I think I'd started street before Darren did. He auditioned right away, but I just worked the street for a while first. I forgot the question. Was there a question?
There were a lot of questions. I don't know anything.
It was about how you structure a street show, but talking about ourselves is much more fun.
It is, I agree. Wait, so Felice, you learned from Gazo, who's a magician, who's a street performer. So Kate, where does someone who does acrobatics and juggling, where do you learn? Is there a resource there? Are there DVDs or books? Or are you literally just throwing yourself out and going, that didn't work?
Well, it's such a weird, closed little society. Some of it is you show up, but please God, don't show up to a really established pitch with no show. Because what they're going to do is they're going to tell you, do not come work here, work somewhere else until you can put a show together. And then you can come join us. My story is a little bit interesting because after that year when I quit in total embarrassment, the next year I ended up getting a theme park gig. So I ended up with this gig at Six Flags Elitch Garden where I had to do 5 shows a day, 5 days a week. So I had to write a show and do a show. And there was none of the pressure that comes with street performing, like street performing. Trying to learn how to street perform and write a show together is very, very difficult. But I did like 200 shows in 2.5 months, you know, something ridiculous like that. I'm sure there's a magician doing the math right now telling me that I'm wrong, but it was a lot. Honestly, that's the key for me, because I would have never gone back to the street after that. But once I had the confidence that I knew I could do a show, I could start, I could finish, and I could end, then I just had to learn all of the different street performing elements. And I was much more comfortable than being able to take tips and advice from the street performers to refine it. And I think that that a little bit is actually gendered, if we want to play this card right now.
Do it.
Because I think a lot of guys are just taught that you can just rock up and do something. But I think that a lot of female performers especially are just taught that failure is embarrassing. And if you embarrass yourself, you're worthless. So I think it's really hard for women to get up and just be humiliated in the way that you have to be humiliated in the first year that you're performing with all of the pressure that might come from the other performers, even if they're nice and supportive, which it's the street, they're not always, but often they are very nice. But just me being able to skip over that level of failure by having that environment where I was set up to do a show and I had to do a show and it was enough shows that at the end I had something that was polished. That is the only way I was going to ever end up as a professional street performer for over a decade.
Yeah, it's also, you get a little bit of extra pressure on you because, at least in magic anyway, it's like if I do a show and I'm not good as a woman, then women can't do magic.
Yeah.
So annoying.
Yeah. That's partially probably why I worked in Hartford for so long before auditioning at Peña. That made for a really good audition.
It did. Like, you killed it. Of the magicians auditioning, your act was the strongest one.
It was raining.
And Felice was such a boss. It's out there. It's raining. She's on the big pitch, a pitch that's bigger than she's ever worked before. Nobody else wants to work. All the other performers are like, man, I don't want to do it. And Felice is like, come to me, people. And they did. It was beautiful.
That's so cool. Yeah. I mean, then if I were booking that, I'd be like, well, that's the magician that can work under the hardest of circumstances. So you get the slot 100%. Being in Boston with Harvard Square, you can do a lot of shows, but I feel like there isn't nearly as much pressure as a place like Faneuil Hall, where Faneuil Hall is known for its street shows. Like, you go there to eat, to shop, and to watch shows, but not in that order either, in the total reverse order. Watch shows and then maybe eat and like get some Sprinkles ice cream. That's just what I did. So I feel like yes, in theory, you could get an ice cream cone with three scoops. But yeah, I think it's really, it feels like you kind of went away where there wasn't a lot of eyes on you to be able to then suddenly come onto the scene and be like, boom, I'm great.
Yeah, so part of it is also that, like, performing in a festival is really easy. Mm. Performing at Faneuil Hall, it's a little bit harder, but still easier than Harvard. Performing in Harvard, nobody's there to watch shows.
Yeah.
I feel like because of that, and also because of Chicago, nobody is there to watch shows either. That's how I worked on developing a show that people would watch.
That's really cool. So, okay. So then talking about backtrack to now, structuring a street show. So we had a bunch of people ask about how to structure a street show. One listener whose name is actually Bart Simpson, not kidding. Bart was asking, how long is your show? Does the show change in length depending on the audience? And how do you even just start by structuring a street show? How do you choose the material? What's important? Can you just walk us through all of that? Again, not me, because I know everything.
The structure depends on the kind of show, but it should always be a three-act show. So it should have a beginning, a middle, and an end. In the beginning of your show, just broadly, you should be doing something quick and accessible. You want to be friendly, approachable, or at least interesting. So you want people to take an interest in what you're doing. For me, as a juggler, I do a lot of like quick tricks that are intriguing, but nothing that's satisfying because I want the people to stay. Middle of the show is when I really build my audience rapport. And that's when I am building a lot of character and I'm doing a lot of audience interaction because I'm trying to keep them there and to get them to like me because they're not paying you because you're good. They're paying you because they like you. Make them feel like a human. Nobody cares that you can juggle seven balls, like literally no one does, unless you make them care, right? Yeah. So that's the middle, is you're building this relationship to hold people. And then the end should be like some big, can I swear?
Yes, you can.
Yeah, it should be some big fuck off trick. Like, it should just be like something that pops, something with a bang, something that you can build up, that's an image that doesn't take a lot of time, has like a big reveal or just a moment that really pops, because right before that, that's when you're going to ask the people for money. So whatever you're doing, you better sell it hard enough to keep them to stay and to think that it's worth seeing. If it's a long, confusing routine, they'll kind of be like, I enjoyed your show. And now my family and I are going to do the thing you interrupted us from doing earlier. So cool.
I think the newest thing for magicians to think about is we have a trick. And then once the payoff for the trick happens, people want to leave. And so in structuring a magic street act, that last thing has to be a thing that's been building the whole time. And so, like, I layer my shows. So I have a first trick, and then I introduce a second trick before the first trick ends. The transitions just have to be extremely, extremely seamless.
That's really clever, is to introduce the next trick before the trick ends.
Yeah. You never want to satisfy your crowd. So you always want those transitions to overlap. So even as I'm finishing my introductory tricks, I'm selling my middle trick. You know, you guys, I'm going to do this three up pirouette right after I do throw the three balls, spin around one time. You guys are going to clap, scream, and cheer. And then I'm going to juggle the knives right after that. So here we go, the three ball juggling. And then I'm going to juggle the knives. And as I'm selling the knives, I'm like, well, but my finale is going to be a handstand. So I'm going to juggle these knives for you guys. And it's going to be amazing. You're going to clap and cheer. And then after that, we go straight to the handstand. No more messing around. There's a lot of messing around, parentheses. No more messing around, right to the finale. And that keeps people engaged with you because, like Felice said, if they're satisfied, then they have other things to do. You are a stranger to them. They did not pay for a ticket. They do not care about you.
I think a lot of magicians probably struggle with just starting a show.
Right.
At the beginning. And I think what's needed there is just awareness of the audience. I do have a 3-act show, but the beginning, like the warm-up tricks or whatever you might call it, sometimes is a little bit more kind of improv. It's not improv because I always do more or less the same thing. That's the opposite of improv, actually.
But yes.
But it's a lot looser. And sometimes I'm like, oh, I haven't done this card trick in a while. I will do this. But like the beginning of the show, I'm just trying to show something to one person. Mm. And as soon as I get a second person interested, I make sure that my awareness isn't just focused on that one person. I expand my awareness. And I think that was the thing that really helped me pull my performing together, was just that I started to notice my audience members more. And I think a lot of magicians start off from a place where they don't even notice their one audience member.
Yeah, sure.
I think a lot of magicians, but this is true of performers in all genres, is you're so focused on your act and your trick that you don't pay attention to the people. But street performing is always about paying attention to your environment. And once you can pay attention to your environment and your audience, people stop feeling like they're watching something that's happening at them, and they start to feel like they're part of something that's happening with them.
Yeah.
Did you watch Magic Camp?
No, not yet. Disney movie. I'm in it.
You're in it?
Oh, yeah?
I'm the hand double in a single scene, I believe.
Ooh.
Which is very cool. I just wanted to
look at you, fancy.
I know, but I haven't watched it yet, no. What were you going to reference?
So the main character, the kid, he's trying to overcome stage fright. There was a scene that Kate commented on when they're trying to teach him to overcome stage fright by just doing cardistry, and all of his friends are trying to distract him. And so Kate's comment was, wow, yeah, you teach someone to become a good performer by telling them to ignore the audience.
They're literally like, you should just stay focused on your trick despite anything that's happening around you. But like, if you're a street performer, you should be paying attention to everything that's happening around you. You should be like, oh, Jimmy, that was a terrible throw. What's the matter with you? Even if you're on a stage, you should be aware of what's happening around you.
Yes.
Like earlier, Felice said she was doing improv, but then she backtracked. But what I think she's talking about is that, yes, it's the same set of skills that she does every single time. And yes, it's roughly the script, but it's happening for different people every time. And she's responding to the situation as it happens.
I agree with you, because I think that is something that we've talked about a lot, but it's so valuable for all performers performing, regardless of who you're performing for, unless it's a camera. And if there are people involved, if you don't acknowledge that they are living, breathing entities of this experience, then they're going to tune out. It's really easy to tune out. And in a theater, it's not a detriment to your show necessarily. I mean, to their experience, yes, but to you as the performer, you'll never know. And in a corporate event, I mean, a lot of times in corporate, if there are 1,500 people, but 500 of them are in the back and they're just drinking and talking, you can still do your show because enough people are paying attention. In a street show, they leave and there's no money. I already have my check for the theater show or the corporate show, but in a street show, you're relying on making sure you engage with your audience. Is that accurate? What am I talking about?
Yeah, definitely. And I think one of the early habits that I developed early on, if I thought people were leaving, I sped up, which made me less present because I was panicking, and which meant they were more likely to want to leave.
Wow.
So I find that if I remember that my jokes are actually enjoyable, I should slow down, even though it's not magical just yet. It ends up becoming something that people actually want to watch again. The tricks are there, but people aren't going to stay if I just speed through the tricks.
No one cares about your tricks.
Right.
No one does. No, they don't. I mean, they care how you make them feel. I don't know. I do a one-handed handstand as my finale on top of like a really tall structure, which is extremely impressive. But I could do a two-handed handstand up there. I could do just juggling up there. It's not about the skill. It's about the way that people feel going on that journey with me at the end of the show. The way that I make them feel is what they pay for.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You could do the most impressive thing in the world, but unless you made people feel like they are engaged with you and have an emotion, then that's what they're looking for. Which I think is also true of all performing, is if you're just doing stuff, like I could watch that on YouTube and it's equally as impressive. But when I actually get to feel and connect, then I'm in. So we've kind of talked a little bit about the structure of the show and the beginning, which is when people come in and decide to watch. What other tactics can you use to get your audience? And I know you both do separate shows. So what are sort of the things you use in your style show to gain an audience besides what you've already talked about?
I guess I use reverse psychology a little bit. So the very first thing I do is a flip stick, just to vanish the stick so that people can see it from far away. And I just repeat that until I get someone interested. And I have a joke there. Vanish the stick, make it reappear, and say, this is how I play fetch by myself.
I like
that. It hasn't happened in a long time.
happy pandemic. Do you have a microphone on while you're doing this?
Yes, I did not start off with one. In Chicago, I did not have one. But once I started having one, and once I developed my persona a little bit more, I needed one because one of my favorite street magic shows is from an Australian magician who I met in Edinburgh. And I learned from watching him that you don't need to be loud and you don't need to like jump all over the place to do a street show, which I thought I needed to do beforehand, you know, just on the street. Like in stage, I understand it's different, but I didn't realize it was the same thing on the street. It's just as long as I'm present and aware, something really quiet can still draw a crowd.
Yeah.
So I use a mic now so I can be my persona.
What about you, Kate?
Well, at the beginning of the show, I do a bunch of small skills. And as I'm doing those skills, I try to look and individually engage the people who seem to be interested. And then another important thing to think about is audience organization. Because if you have a crowd that's standing back and just half paying attention, then people are going to think that you are half interesting. So what you really want to do is at the beginning, once you've established enough of a rapport with people, you want to bring them in, and then you eventually want to have a specific shape. Like magicians will often do it differently. For us, it's the circle. Sometimes we use cones or rope or waterline on the ground. It just gives the audience a shape. And when they see that people are watching something and enjoying it, then they think, I'm a person who likes to enjoy things. I would also like to watch. And because of that, I also have several what I think of as pull-in points at the show. So a crowd will attract a crowd. And as you start going through the show, you'll start to get more people. And those people may not join the audience in an organized kind of way. So there will be certain points where I'm about to do something interesting, or I feel like I have power in the audience, where I'll pull them in together to make them form a tighter circle. Because the more people are close together, the more they're going to relax and enjoy themselves and clap and cheer. The more people who are watching your show, the more people who are going to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
So if your show gets big enough, you can even sit your front row or your second row so that the people behind can then see. Because at a certain point, if you can't see someone, it's a cliche that street performers always have a tall object to stand on. But if you can't see someone, you're not going to give them money because you didn't see anything. So the more people who can see you, the more people who will pay you.
Yeah, that's so cool. So then you're doing the show. You've got the crowd. You can sit there. I love the idea of sitting down the front row because that also feels like people want to sit to watch your show, which means they're not just standing in the back slowly waiting to leave. It's like, no, they're invested, which is so cool that that is also a thing.
It's a bit of a gambit because if they don't like you enough, they won't do it. And then you start to lose control of the crowd
or they'll do
it resentfully. And then the audience turns a little and it becomes difficult. So you kind of have to really develop a sense of where your crowd is with you.
Which makes all this really hard post-pandemic because the show builds because there's a crowd and they're standing very close to each other. Like I've tried to build a show with me and the audience further away so that there's more potential for them to become bigger. But I found that my biggest shows happen when I start with them really tight and really close in, and then they build kind of outwardly layers that way. So when I try to start with them a little bit further away, just because of the nature of, I think, my show and my props are much smaller. If they don't start at the very beginning up close, they won't build.
Sure.
So 6 feet away from each other, I don't know.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. And now neither of you have done a show during the pandemic.
Virtually only.
Yeah,
some
virtually.
Places in the world, people have like made attempts or come up with theories on how to do it. We've discussed amongst ourselves how we might do it again. Like the street performers have discussed amongst ourselves how we might do it when things reopen. But everything is mostly theoretical, involving X's on the ground and people who you hope will listen to you, but probably won't.
Yes. And also they can get close at their own risk kind of situation. But you're right. It's like just being in the audience of street shows is, I feel like, that closeness of the audience makes me feel like this is worth watching. But also it's the same in a theater too, is that the fact that we're having to space people out in a theater means that there's less of a chance. The idea of like, if you're sitting next to somebody and something funny happens and you both laugh, then that laughter grows because you're having also a moment with the people around you. And then now we're spacing everybody out, that doesn't get to happen. So that feels like it's going to affect all of us, but it's interesting how it'll affect street shows. Like, will the audiences stay even though they're not close?
Yeah, because with the distance, it's like laughing at a movie in your room. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you feel kind of dumb. If people are right next to you laughing, then you don't feel bad cheering and shouting and laughing because you're part of something with people. Yes. But like, if you're just some jerk standing by yourself going, you feel kind of dumb.
That's so weird. Oh, goodness. So going back to the show specifically, Bart had asked about the length of the shows. I think you did, you know, really good job of saying beginning, middle, end. You layer the transitions, which I think is really, really cool. How long is a normal show?
Up to 30 minutes, I think, for a Sidewalk Magic show. But it can be 20 minutes. I can do three shows in the time it takes Kate to do one show. So Kate's show is like 45 minutes to an hour.
Oh, wow.
Including the build.
Including the build. That's if the build is going very, very poorly. Because people get very tired watching you. There is a certain amount of patience that people have. So the nice thing about street is that it does teach you where your show is dragging. Mm. And you need to cut all of that. Literally, nobody cares that you found these cards in an Egyptian mummy tomb and there was a curse on it that was explained to you by an archaeologist in 1918. No one cares. Keep it moving. If the show is going really well and I have my crowd quickly, then I can do the whole show in 25 to 35 minutes. Mm. The material itself, if I were to do the material without an audience responding to it, I probably have like 15 to 20 minutes of material. The rest of it comes with the interaction with the crowd, the way that they respond, the way that I respond to them, the jokes. Your show should not be too long. It should be as long as you need to make money.
Mm. Well, you might have separate answers on this question. This is another question from our good buddy Bart Simpson. But when I first moved to LA, I was like, I'm going to drive for Lyft to make some money while I'm trying to figure out how to do magic in Los Angeles. And my Lyft driving experience lasted 3 rides. It was awful. But what I learned from the guy who was like, take me around, let me see how you drive, how's your car, do you have seatbelts? He said, it's better to do more shorter rides than one long ride because you'll make more money in the tips. And he was right because that is exactly what happened. But then I quit and I couldn't actually prove it. Is that the same point in a street show? Would you rather do a bunch of shorter shows or would you rather do one longer, bigger show? What gets you more money? What's more preferred? And you might have different answers because you do totally different shows.
Yeah. I'm going to think about festivals just to add some context. Yeah. I think in a festival, a big circle show would do 2, maybe 3 shows.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's like 2-3 hour slots. And within that hour, there's setup and there's breakdown and a whole bunch of things in between. A magician would probably work all day, 8 hours maybe. And I think the outcome is potentially the same at the end of the day, maybe. Maybe not. Sometimes, depending on who you are, if you're a really good magician.
And are you doing shorter shows with a smaller crowd as the magician? Is that sort of what's going on?
Yes, yes, yes.
Got it.
For me, it's all about trying to gauge the show when it's at its peak. So if I start the show too soon and I don't have enough audience, then the people who come at the end are probably not going to pay as much. So I want to have enough time in the show for the audience to build to a big enough size that it's going to be worth my time for me to finish this show. Not that I bail out on a lot of shows, but like I'm trying to do the show as long as the audience is with me. Because if you start and you finish the show before you have enough of a crowd, you're not going to have enough of a crowd to pay you. But if you go too long trying to milk it, your audience might stay out of a sense of obligation, but they also might get exhausted.
Yeah.
And if they're exhausted, then they're not going to pay as much. They might still pay you something because they've spent all this time with you and they love you and you did a great job, but they're just real tired and they just want to go.
Mm-hmm.
But if you hit it at that peak where the crowd is big enough and they still love you and they feel fresh and they feel excited, then they'll give you the money. The range is going to be a total time of somewhere in that neighborhood between 25 and 45 minutes, depending.
What's really interesting for me right now is because I don't know anything about street shows, even though I'm an expert. So I'm learning so much. Like, I didn't know that there were different shows, and this is really cool. I feel like what I hear from a lot of people, and I know this is not accurate, you can't make a lot of money street performing. And I know that's not true. Or like, oh, it's just so sporadic on how much money you can make. You don't need to tell us how much money you make a show. But my question more is, can you pretty much gauge at this hour on this day, I know I'm going to make between, you know, within $20 of each other, or like, this is a peak hour, so I'm going to make this amount of money here and this amount of money here. Can you pretty much, after doing it for so long, can you pretty much know about the amount of money you're going to take in a show?
Not always in a show, but often in a week. Like, I'll have a weekly goal and play the averages. The amount that you're going to make during a given show depends on so much. It depends on you. It depends on how good your hat line is. It depends on the audience. It depends on if they like you. It depends on the weather. If they're hot, they're not going to want to stay. If they're cold, they're not going to want to stay. If they were cold and it got warmer, they're going to leave. Or if it was really warm out, but then they are in shorts and it got cold, then they're going to leave. They're in the shade. You know what I mean? Like, if people are distracted by something, then they're going to give less. There's so many different factors. Sometimes you have a massive crowd and you're like, I am going home a millionaire. And all of them give $1 or none.
Oh, no.
And you're like, I thought I was rich. And sometimes you do a little show in the middle of the night for like 10 people. And those 10 people felt so personally engaged that they all give good tips. And you're like, I don't know why I even do this. So I try to play the averages over like a week or a season or whatever. And if I'm falling behind, I just do more shows.
What you're saying, it's pretty similar to doing bar magic. By the end of the week, I could pretty much gauge how much money I was going to be taking home in a week or in a month or something like that. Nightly, no, but definitely in a week, I could pretty much guarantee how much money I was going to make. So it seems pretty similar as you set a goal and just try to make that.
Yeah. The magician friend of mine that I learned a lot from when I was in Chicago, he was probably one of the best bar magicians there at that time. He was at the Chicago Magic Lounge doing bar magic very early when they were still the Uptown Underground.
Yeah.
And John Sterk there said to me that I think street and bar are really similar in that you need to talk to your audience and interact with them in that way.
Yeah, it feels like the main difference is they're already just sitting there. So you don't have to ask them to watch you. They're right in front of you. They'll watch because they're not doing anything. And there's alcohol. So there's an activity to do while they're watching you. And also they want more alcohol and you're the person giving it to them. So you're like, oh, this is easy.
That's your draw, right? You're like, oh, you're here for the alcohol. You're watching, paying attention. By the way, that's your crowd build is you're giving them booze.
That's smart.
And if you're smart about it, I'm sure you could find techniques to convince more people to come to your bar to watch your show. And then that you build a bigger crowd and get a better hat.
Yeah.
It is street performing, but it's in a bar.
Right. It's funny because I'll go, bar magic's kind of like street performing, but way easier. And maybe it's not. Maybe it just provides you tools without you having to think about it. That's cool.
Try it again.
I will try it again. Well, I mean, you know, when bars open and I mean, when streets open.
Oh, yeah. Try street again.
Try street again.
You know, to be honest, I'm fine.
And we'll counsel you. We will give you your emotional counseling and support first time. We'll let you know that it's fine and you're still a good person. And although if you street perform for too long, that might not be true anymore.
We should do this. This could be a fun experiment. I'll come to Boston and I'll just try street shows for like a week and then I'll regret it. But I'll have you there to be like, no, it's okay, Gila. You can do other skills.
We'll go to Harvard. We'll work in rotation with you. We'll do it.
Yeah. There was a time I was in Harvard. Kate was in, Faneuil Hall. And I was having a really bad day. And I think I started texting you. It was like line by line of all the bad things that were happening at the pitch. It's like my coffee spilled. Someone spilled coffee all over my pitch. It was just, and I didn't realize at the time, but Kate was sharing it with another my line by line play.
It was really perfect comic timing too. It was beautiful. I should find those messages. It was great.
That's so cool. Like the bar as well is you have so many variables that you have no idea what's going to be thrown at you, which is also why you have to pay attention. I love it. So very briefly played this card, but let's go back to it, which is the point of Shazam. I hate the question of what's it like to be a woman in your industry, because there should be no answer, but there is. And so I'm very curious what it's like to be a woman in the street world, but also your experience in the magic world, Felice, and your experience within the acrobatic and juggling world, Kate. What has that been like for both of you? What are some of the positives and negatives of your gender? Felt like I should say that.
Performer.
Yeah.
Solo.
Yeah.
And I'm a magician, by the way. Hi.
I get it.
Wait, Felice, are you saying that you're not someone's girlfriend? Did you wander into the convention hall by accident?
Did you pay for your own registration?
Yeah. Are you lost?
Are you actually going to a lecture or to the spouses event?
I also got one. Are you shoot a gala?
No. Yeah.
I really wish the listeners at home could see the reaction that you had, the violent reaction that you just had, Kayla.
Oh my God. Oh no, because as soon as
that you started. That was a joke.
It was a joke?
It was a joke, but it was.
Terrible joke. See, but, I would like if someone said, are you Juliana Chen or Jade or Julie Egg, because I guess all Asian American women are the same, but the fact that someone asked you, no, I can't, I quit, I'm done, this podcast will never be obsolete, I'm over it. I'm literally, can you see me sinking into the couch? I'm so mad. Please continue.
It was people trying to backtrack. It was like, first, are you a loss? And then it's like, oh no, okay, and then are you Shudagawa? And then they're just trying to make jokes to backtrack, but the jokes that they were grabbing were not good jokes. And then at that point, there was also a compliment on my English abilities. So it was a lot. That was back when I just moved to this area.
There's so much wrong with this story. I'm scratching my own head. I'm so mad. Okay, great. So that's nice. So then... someone else talk.
I can't. Yeah. Hey, because I used to think that jugglers and magicians were like the same kind of nerds, and we were just as bad as each other, you know, because it's both like kind of closed communities of an intensive like skill-based thing that could also be a performance that you practice alone. So I thought we were very similar kind of nerdly communities until Felice told me what going to a magic convention was like. And then that's when I sent you that meme. There's this meme that we got sent around the juggling community. It's the wake-up call meme. Like, yes, I'd like a wake-up call. And the person says, your community is inclusive of women and minorities, but only compared to magicians.
It's so true. So then what is the juggling community like for women?
It is like 10 years ahead, maybe 5.
Unclear. Oh, great. I'm so jealous.
In all honesty, when I first started juggling, it was very, very rare to see another woman in the gym, especially another woman who was working on technical skills. Juggling is a very different kind of community because in our conventions, the floor is open. The vendors are along the outside of the gym, and then the gym space is common. So essentially, all we do at juggling conventions is jam and trade skills and hang out and show off. So there's a little bit less of that cloistered feeling. I mean, there is that sense of you have to prove yourself, but also you're in the middle of a floor proving yourself. So you don't have to go up to everyone individually. But when I did start juggling, I was definitely almost always not seeing women in the gym. If I was seeing a woman who was technically skilled, usually they were a passing duo. They were part of a duo with a man, or else they were like a girlfriend or a wife who had sort of learned how to juggle. But there was that whole display of skill, display of failure. You didn't see a lot of like hardcore technical women juggling. And now as I go to juggling festivals, I see more and more women who are juggling 5 balls out on the floor. And that also puts that goal out there. If you're a young girl coming into a juggling festival, all you see are women passing. All you see are girlfriends or daughters or sisters. And the men are so overwhelmingly good, because you're not going to ever focus on the men who aren't good, because you just don't pay attention to the people who aren't good. So all you see is these men who are so overwhelmingly good. You see the girlfriends, you see the wives, you see the sisters, you see the passing duos. You have a sort of an acceptable path. But now if you walk into a gym and you see a bunch of women out there juggling 5 or more, then you're going to be like, oh, well, I guess 5 is just the thing I have to learn. So it's not good. And the men are not always good with the things they say and the comments that they make, but they are getting better and they are trying. And with your podcast, that's something that I'm seeing happening in the magic community too. And I find that's really exciting. And I really have enjoyed the work that you have been putting in to making this happen.
Thanks.
On the street, there are very few women, like, you know, as opposed to magic, just street performing. But same thing as in magic and in juggling, being a solo performer. If I'm walking around with anyone else, people think I'm a dual act. And then when I'm not, I think the hardest thing is just trying to get, if I were in a community of other street performers, to get other street performers to see and respect me. But that's part of the reason why it took me so long to become a part of either the magic community or the street performing community as it is. Yeah. Which is why I was like in Hartford Square by myself for quite a while.
Yeah. I think that's really smart of you. And I started so young to where then I was kind of thrown into a lot of spotlight situations, but I was good for my age, but I never got better. And then I became bad. So I went away. And then by the time I came back, I was still bad, but I was better. And then I went away again. And eventually by the time you come back and you go, hey, magic community, what up? Then they're like, oh, snap, we should pay attention to you. So I think a really smart thing to do is hone your skill before the community is going to judge you.
That's one thing that someone I was sharing a pitch with said to me. He said, oh, wow, Felice, you're a natural. And I told this to Kate. And Kate was like, I've seen how hard you work, Felice. I mean, I don't think that was you playing down my talent, but no. It was playing up the work that had to be put in.
Felice has put so much work into developing your show and developing her crowd control and developing the routines and everything. Like, it is definitely not a natural ability. Like, it is very well honed. It's, I believe in the industry, we call it craft.
Craft. That's so right.
Can I tell my knack story?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I know this story. I have heard this story from neither of you, but really? Yes, please tell it because it was on my list of questions.
Is this Rebecca? May
I? So Felice is describing the magic community to me and she's telling me about a trick that it doesn't work right away. You have to work on it over and over and over again until it just clicked. And I turned to Felice and I said, you mean practice?
Yeah. Do you know? So that story has gotten, I don't know when that happened. How long ago did that happen?
Like a while. A couple of years ago. Yeah.
So I have now heard that story from maybe 3 or 4 different people. And I only recently found out that it was you, Kate, saying that. And was
oh my God.
Oh my God. That's a really funny. I just met her. I'm going to ask you about this because now when I give lessons, I still use the word like, okay, listen, this is a really knacky move. And all that means is you're just going to have to put in the time. And yes, because magicians say that all the time. And it's just to validate like, oh, this is hard.
Oh my God. I want to know who you heard this from.
So like multiple people. It was not just like one person.
Our friend Zach Evans, he lived here his first summer street performing.
We took him in. You ever see Growing Pains when they brought in Leonardo DiCaprio to spice things up? Like, we had an empty room for the summer and we brought in Zach.
That's awesome.
So he's going to listen to this.
Yeah. Well, he looked exactly like him. We even showed him the pictures.
So cool.
But he's much more extroverted than I am. And he's very involved in the magic community. So he probably tells the story. So I feel like he would be the one because I don't really talk to magicians in a very wide sense.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Have you found that your gender has been helpful in any specific way in your careers and industries? Go.
I will tell you that there are male street performers who believe that might be the case.
Yep.
But they're like, oh, it's so easy. You just have to stand out there and people will watch you because they like to watch ladies. And I'm like, that is not the attention I want, friend. That is not what I'm doing. That is not.
That's weird.
So that was a big discussion on the internet. Street performing boards. So many internet communities that are going to hate me after this podcast.
Listen, if they don't hate me, well, they do hate me. I don't know where I was going with this email. Go ahead.
So, I have a theory. And it's kind of ties into the why women are bad. And I think of it as like the arc of perceived competence. So you show up at a pitch and you're terrible. but people want to see more women on the pitch. If you're in a helpful pitch, some people just dismiss you out of hand as an idiot and they try to do everything they can to belittle you. Because this is street performing, it's a low barrier to entry. So you're going to come into a diverse level of professionalism and quality of human beings. Some of my street performer friends are amazing and they're the nicest people I've ever met in my life. And some of them I just never will trust and always have to watch my back around.
Sure.
That's also, you've talked to producers for indoor shows. So like,
same game, yeah.
Exactly. There's money involved. Everybody's jockeying for position. That's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So you show up to a pitch. You're nobody. People are like, oh my God, it's a girl. Like, wow, we'd love to have more women street performers. Let us give you all kinds of help. Some of it will be very condescending and some of it will actually be useful to you. But we don't take you seriously at all. But it's so nice to have like a little puppy here. You know, we can just teach you things and you'll learn. Oh, that's what I call it. I call it the puppy theory. So
that's right.
Yeah, because then you get a little bit better. And as you get a little bit better, then you start to want to be treated like a person who is a little bit better, but you're not good yet.
Right.
And if you're not undeniably good, then you're always going to be perceived as just a little bit worse than a male performer who is at exactly the same competence level. Mm-hmm. Then you start to get to that high intermediate level and you start to really try to assert yourself and be like, I am a real person. I am a good performer. Damn it. Treat me like you treat everybody else. And then people are like, aw. These can't be people. You tried so hard. But you, just because you're standing on your hind legs doesn't mean you're a real person. So we're just not going to take you super seriously.
Yep.
Then you're very lucky and you keep pushing through all of the self-doubt because of all of the terrible critique you've got that's not relevant to your show. Some of it might be, which how do you know? You don't. Then you get to be very good. And then people are like, oh my God, a woman that's good? That's amazing. We want you in all of the things and we're going to praise you way too much. But like, wow, what amazing find we have found. I see the eyes of agreement, Kayla.
I would like to show you the eyes, the head nod, the handshake, and the high five of agreement. I think that at least for me, and then Felice, I'd love to get your thoughts as well, because I feel like in LA, because LA pretends to be progressive in a lot of ways. And it is and it isn't. There are a lot of people that really want to push things to a better mindset, better place, better community. And then there are people that are like, I just got to do it in order to work in this industry. And what ends up happening is people really love magic in LA. They want to hire magicians all the time. And they say, I want to hire a magician, but I want it to be different than the normal magic show. And what they mean is, I don't want a white guy. So that ends up being helpful for someone like me, who gets a lot of calls going, I want a magician. I thought it would be really cool to have a woman. And that's great because if I get the call, then I know if I can't do the show, I know I can dole it out to someone who I know is really, really good. Or if I do the show, not to have an ego, but I'm aware of my self-worth and I'm like, well, I know I'm going to do a good show and not only represent me, but also represent women in this industry in the best possible way. Or at least as good as I possibly can. But what ends up sometimes happening is they don't have a big budget. And what they end up getting is a woman who's been doing magic for 6 months, and then they never want to hire another woman in this industry again. And so it is helpful sometimes, but I wouldn't say I get more work than the guys. I'd say I get different opportunities.
I'm going to agree with you completely, and I will let you talk, Felice. But the thing that I've bumped up against is that a lot of major busker festivals have a woman slot, maybe two. They want to have a woman on the program. And because there are very few women on the industry, it is perceived that it is easier to get a job because you're a woman. And that can be true as you're starting out. But what will eventually start to happen is you'll bump up to them filling that woman slot. So they have two female performers. They don't necessarily care who they are. And they fill those spots and then they're gone. So you're competing against the entire women of street performing for two spots. Whereas I would prefer to be competing as a handstand show, but obviously I'm going to take the woman spot because I need a job.
Right.
So like you just said, there are more opportunities and it's easier to get noticed, but at the same time, they are different opportunities because there are other opportunities that are closed. Mm. Like I've performed literally right next to another handstand show. And the bookers didn't even think that we might be the same kind of act.
Yeah. Felice?
I think I had a gig once and I was like, wait, I do feel like they gave me this gig because I'm a woman. But then also when I was thinking this through, you were like, yeah, but it's also much harder to get to where I am. Yeah. So it just kind of balances that a little bit. Like, sure, at a certain point, there may be opportunities that someone else at my level who is a guy would not get. But there's probably a lot of kids out there, little girls who start off interested, and then for one reason or another, they drop off. Mm-hmm. And to have continued to do it and persisted, that just means you've overcome a little bit more. That sounds really weird. But yeah.
No, I understand, because in magic, things are very gender specific and they're made for a specific type of human and with a specific type of costume, a specific type of physical attribute, and a specific type of mindset as well. So when you don't fit that mold, then you're like, I got to problem solve. And sometimes you don't know enough to problem solve so you can quit. But yeah, I totally agree. It's like, yeah, it's just taken me a little longer to get here.
Great. Kate calls me surprise Felice when I do a show.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I am a lot more comfortable around people who are like me in various ways. When I'm around my friends, Darren Makoto, I open up a lot easier right away, even if I didn't know them. It's just a lot faster. But generally, I am more introverted than other performers. And so, in a group of people don't look at me and think, performer.
Mm.
But once I'm on stage and thinking of some of my acts, I think people are surprised, which is why Kate calls me surprise Felice.
It's so great. I love to watch her street show with other street performers who don't know Felice because they'll look at her and she seems so unassuming and she'll be setting up her table and they're kind of like, waiting for this show to start. They're going to see it. And then all of a sudden, Felice bangs her stick on the table and is like, you stop and watch. And people are like, why, I will. And then the next thing you know, Felice has this great crowd and they are in love with her. And it's not a thing that anybody saw coming except for me, because I saw it happen before. And this actually goes back to your point. When you're talking about magic is tailored to a certain type of person, it's just really similar on the street. Some street performers like to believe their own propaganda and that they're the most creative art form. A lot of street performers are just ripping off other shows. They steal different jokes. It's not quite as bad as it is with magic, where there's a script that comes with a trick, but the street performers steal the joke and then just plug them in themselves and feel like they've written a show. But none of those jokes work for women. A lot of those street formats don't work for women. For example, I found that if I am too aggressive, then people won't stop and watch me.
Yeah.
But I'm still very mean, but in a very friendly way.
Yeah.
And I find that draws people in. But I had to learn that I couldn't just tell a mean joke. I couldn't tell a stock line. It would fall flat. So now when I'm building a crowd, I do something like, oh my gosh, ma'am, your shoes are so great. You know where they would look great? They would look great in the front row of my audience right here. And you guys, look at this attractive couple that I've got watching in the front row. They are so, if you stand next to them, people will think that you are attractive too. Which is a really mean thing to say, but it's so inviting.
That is,
it's
that's
not
so
threatening. But it's just I found that the format didn't work for me, so I had to write my own show. Mm. And a lot of women that I perform with, it's the same thing for them. There is not yet a female street show archetype. It is developing, but it doesn't exist yet. So there's a lot more variety in the types of women street performers that you see.
And that's also why it's so hard for women, because we can't just take and copy.
Yeah.
We could, but then it doesn't work.
You have to learn to perform, learn to street perform, learn to build a crowd, learn to draw a crowd, learn to write a script, all at exactly the same time.
And that's also very similar to magic, where I just didn't feel like anything really worked for me. So I just made my own stuff. Boom. And then you end up being this great, I think Felice, you could say that, but all of us, I think a lot of women who do this professionally or semi-professionally at any sort of professional level can go, well, I didn't have anybody to copy. So look how unique I am now. Which, yeah, it's harder, but it ends up paying off in the end, all the hard work, because then now people copy me. Now people copy you, because now we are the ones to be, because we're the unique, interesting kind of performers, which is always a lot of people ask, what do women bring to magic? Why should magic care about more women? And it's because we're freaking great. Shut up. But I think that's it. Because we don't have anybody to copy, we just bring this crazy new unique perspective.
I'm kind of looking forward to seeing the cliche female magician, honestly. We'll have gotten to a point, right? We're like, oh God, not another girl magic show.
Yeah, I feel like for a hot second, all the women wanted to be Melinda. So they were all wearing really scantily clad costumes and doing illusions that had sort of sexual innuendo built into them. And then we realized, I don't want to do that.
That wasn't your style, Kayla? You didn't do that?
God, no.
No.
There is almost 0% of me that is sexy. So we're good here. That's weird.
We all just have awkward shows. The three of us. We do.
They're so weird and kind of sarcastic and awkward, and that's the best.
There's nothing sex potty about my show. There's just nothing. It's just very strange and a
Which
little
is
mean.
Great. It's great. No, same. Yeah, just like a hint of mean to remind you that I'm in control, which is awesome. Bringing it back to what we're talking about. Felice.
Yes.
You wrote an article.
I did.
Which is so good. Can you talk about it?
Yeah. You know Felicity Hartfield?
Mm-hmm.
So she's writing a column about various social issues, and she didn't feel comfortable writing about race. So she reached out to me. I think that she knew a little bit about my background studying anthropology. And so that was what I drew from. And I also wanted to be really careful. The same way that like when Shazam started, like feminism wasn't that common to talk about. Mm-hmm. I think race issues is currently, I think, everywhere. But when I had written this article, it was a few months even before all this. And it's something that I think a lot about and talk a lot about in like private conversations. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to find a way to really just get people to empathize. And so I was trying to think about who to speak with. I know Julie Young, we met in Toronto. And then my friend Makoto was the one who introduced me to Ed Kwan to talk to him. And a lot of that was, how do I say things about my experiences without telling people this is what it's like? Why don't we just focus on two people who have very wildly different experiences in it, but they are still rooted in the same background and culture? And so Ed has gotten some just very bad experiences on, specifically at the Magic Castle.
Yep.
And I think what I deal with more day-to-day is more like microaggressions. And I'm usually just like, oh, that happened. That's funny. Haha. In my head. You know, I might share like privately with friends, but I have not gotten any of those experiences that Ed has. And a lot of that is mixed in with being someone who is from a different country. But also, I think gender has a thing to do with it as well. Just Asian women tend to be fetishized and Asian men tend to be also feminized, but in a bad way, slightly.
Got it.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
The issues there are different, and I just wanted to tell his story. And the other thing in magic is just how often Asian props are used and how...
I'm mad. Keep going. I didn't mean to cut you off. I just had to vocalize.
No, it happens a lot. So I was hanging out with my friend Jackie in Toronto, Jackie Swan.
I love Jackie. Great, keep going.
Yeah, and she was doing the trick with the Chinese coins and the ribbon.
Yeah, it's literally just like Chinese coins and ribbons. Like it's,
I
forget the name of it.
Yes, Charming Chinese.
There it is. Wow. Neither of the magicians knew.
He's the racist one. Jesus Christ, what a thing.
That was amazing.
But we were hanging out and she was doing the trick and I was narrating the trick and just renaming it, changing the pattern entirely so that it was like Charming Colonialist coins. And it went this weird way because it was after a show. But it was just fun to tell a completely different story with the same props and the same trick. And it was just making fun of that narrative. I don't know where this is going anymore. I was talking about Ed Kwan.
Ed Kwan, the article. Cultural appropriation.
Yes, and Ed Kwan is a very, very nice person and extremely articulate. Yes. I've never met him in person, but it was really nice to talk to him over the phone twice.
I've also heard a couple of Ed's stories outside of this article. And one thing that, amongst a lot of things, is that there's such deeply rooted issues within magic history that haven't actually been challenged on a broad scale. And some of that is misogyny and sexism. Some of that is homophobia, anti-Semitism. And then you have cultural appropriation, which is the massive one, because you can see that when you go into a magic shop. You can't necessarily see everything else laid out in front of you on the counter to buy a prop or in a book or whatever it is. Cultural appropriation is literally just serving it to you on a platter in magic. And I bought a routine that I really loved, some coin gimmicks, and involved in the coin gimmicks was racist coin, and which is what I call it, because it's not actually currency spendable in China. It's a racist coin. And so immediately got rid of it, right? And from there, it's like, why is this still a thing? Just the other day, a magician posted a backdrop of this thing going, what does this say in whatever Asian language this is? And of course, it didn't say anything. It said no words. And people were like, it kind of means this, this, and this, but also it doesn't. It's a combination of all of this and a bad artist rendering. And it's like, why are you using this?
Right.
You are a white.
you're a white. No, it's so when I see it, I know I have friends who are insulted. I'm not offended when I see it. What happens though when I see it is I'm taken out of whatever is going on. It's like, what is this supposed to represent? It has nothing to do with Asian culture. This performer is not Asian. And they're trying to tell a story of a make-believe country that I don't identify with and they don't identify with. So it's just not so much, instead of thinking about offensiveness, I think about it as in just weird, bad magic.
Mm.
It's like the sports team, the Redskins.
Yeah, yeah.
One of many. One of several.
It's the only one.
Because I guess that's what caricatures are. It's not anything that I identify with, but it's a thing that people think that I identify with. And I guess that's where the offense comes in.
It feels like, now I'm just saying what I've understood. I am white, so my culture is not appropriated ever. So I can't actually speak from this from experience, but it feels like there's just a complete disregard for actually caring about a culture and just using the parts that benefit your career and your performance, which frustrates me to say, I'm just going to step on over actual people. And I like your way of saying it where it's, you just made up a country. Like, that's not a real country. You just made it up. And you made it up for your own personal gain, which is so maddening to me. And it is still a rampant thing in magic. One thing that we did in another episode of Shazam recorded so far for season 3, but I want to make it a thing as like a little segment, is I'm just renaming tricks. So like the Hindu shuffle. My least favorite, which is still something that makes me cringe, is Chink-a-Chink. That's a trick.
Yeah. Yeah. I got a friend who just sent me a message of a famous magician who wrote something recently with that trick in there and said, it's not offensive in this context. I'll send it to you after. But it was still offensive. But like, I don't know. Maybe I called it not offensive because I've been in the magic community for too long. It is a thing that I do kind of roll my eyes at when it happens. It's, I think, the same way when gender things come up. It's an eye roll. It's a thing that happens. And then it's just like, okay, there's a magic community and then there's the people I hang out with.
Yeah. Yeah. But I also appreciate that you and also people like Ed and others are willing to share their experiences, because we can all have our communities that like, oh, these are our safe people. And I'm really happy to have my safe people. But you can only have your safe people for so long. There's still a really annoying part of the community that just hasn't learned yet. And that's why Shazam was started. That's why articles like yours are written. It's like, all right, we're done here. This is no longer a thing. Move along. It's time to educate and understand people so that magic is supposed to be for everybody. All the nerds and introverts that can't make friends normally.
That's why we got into magic.
Yeah. Yep. But I love it. I love the article so much. Can you also just quickly tell people, where can they find this article?
It's online. It's on Vanish Magazine. I can send you the link.
We're going to link to it in the show notes so that everyone can click on it and read it, because it's amazing.
You know, we all have tons and tons of anecdotes, and we could just sit around like shooting a shit talking about how terrible it is. But also the reality is it's a challenge. It's a different kind of challenge that we have to confront and get through. Like, we're not sharing these stories necessarily to say, oh, magic is bad. The street performing community is bad, because it's a community. It's a group of people like any other. But we do have real challenges. Sometimes the sitting around and bitching is just to alleviate our own problems. But also, yeah, we shouldn't have to play those cards of how bad is it? Well, this one time, this person came up and said this to me in the middle of my show. Or like, I don't know, is it any tougher being a female street performer? Well, one time a guy walked into the middle of my circle and smacked my ass in the middle of a show. But I shouldn't have to pull that card, because every time they get you to pull that card, then they attack the anecdote.
Hmm.
You know, like, we should just be able to say like, hey, we're women in street performing, we're women in magic, we have these challenges, like, we should grow as a community to get past that.
I completely agree with everything that we're all saying. So just because it happens and it's terrible doesn't mean it's an excuse, because if it was an excuse, then we would have quit a long time ago. We're all here making a living. So boom.
The Historical Women segment is sponsored by the Penguin Magic podcast hosted by Eric Tate. Thurston is a name you probably know because of Howard Thurston, the very famous magician that took over the mantle from Keller. But you may or may not have heard of the name Jane Thurston, who was Howard Thurston's stepdaughter. She was known in magic magazines as the Maid, M-A-I-D, of magic, and she would produce silks and fish bowls and do amazing large production style magic, all while dancing and singing. She would perform new material in Thurston's show every season, and by 1931, she was performing a complete black art act, along with a floating ball routine, a production of a line of women and a man on a tightrope, and even a self-levitation. Soon after she had developed all of this material and was becoming an integral part of the tour, large production shows kind of went away because of the Great Depression. The show then became much smaller and then toured in the coming years. While on tour, Thurston's wife and Jane's mother fell ill, and while Thurston went home to take care of her, and unfortunately she ended up passing away, Jane continued on with the show. A few years later, what ended up being Thurston's final tour, he had designed an illusion to present Jane as sort of this new famous magician of the time. So there was this giant book that turned pages past a photo of Keller, then Thurston, and then the production of Jane. And at the time, she was only 23 years old, but was slated to be the next famous magician of the time, taking that over from her stepdad. Unfortunately, shortly after this tour, there were all these financial issues that caused them to put the show into storage. Thurston then died shortly later, and sadly, Jane never made her way to the stage again. However, even though she never performed after this, she certainly had her place in magical history as this amazing, touring, famous magician of the time. The segment is sponsored by the Penguin Magic podcast, hosted by Eric Tate. Every week, if you listen to the podcast, you get a 25% discount code on the featured download of the week, so you can hear stories from your favorite magicians, behind the scenes at Penguin, and save money on some of the best new magic. Who doesn't want that? So visit podcast.penguinmagic.com to find out more. Our books to read segment this week is brought to you by, I wonder. Oh yeah, it's a bunch of books, the Eli Marks Mystery Series, of course. This week's book is Ain't I a Woman by Bell Hooks. Now, Bell Hooks is this really amazing feminist writer. She has also written a book that I'm reading currently called Feminist Theory, which could be a totally different week of a book to read. Anti-Woman is an amazing book about racism and feminism, about sexism on Black women during slavery, and ideas on how to move past sexist and racist assumptions. So this book is really, really valuable in moving forward and getting some core values to then actually create change. I would also say that, just as like an additional addendum, Feminist Theory is a book that I think we should all read as well. It's actually a fairly short read, but incredibly impactful and powerful, that gives us a lot of information, again, building up that foundational knowledge and feminist theory in order to move forward and actually make the world a better place. So, I mean, really, I could just say the book to read this week is anything Bell Hooks has ever done, but specifically, Ain't I a Woman by Bell Hooks. This segment was sponsored by the Eli Marks Mystery Series. Jim Steinmeier, master illusionist, said, "A wonderfully engaging, delightfully tricky bit of mystery. Fans of magic will delight in the artful use of the world of magicians on stage and off stage. It's a great story and great fun, and you can pick up the first book in the series, The Ambitious Card, for only 99 cents. So grab your copy at elimarksmysteries.com. That's E-L-I-M-A-R-K-S mysteries.com. The Let's Make It Vanish segment is sponsored by the LA Collusion. One thing that needs to vanish in magic is asking an audience volunteer to either reach into your front pants pocket or to touch the area near your front pants pocket in order to either have the final reveal of the trick or as a convincer to say the object is still there before it's gone. You might also be thinking, Kayla, are you referencing once again the abstract effects trick cake presented by Jabrizi? And no, I am not. I am talking about specifically asking an audience volunteer as an integral part of your routine to touch the area by your front pants pocket. Gross. I don't think I need to explain to you why this is disgusting. Especially if this is, I mean, this shouldn't happen at all. There should be at no point you are asking an audience member to touch the area of your body near your genitals. That is pretty gross. And then when you've also made it a very important part of the trick where you kind of make it feel like they have no choice because, oh no, you need to touch this area. You need to take the object out because I don't want to touch it. You have to do this or the trick doesn't work. Then there's so much pressure on them to do this right, and now you're asking them to put their hand somewhere they don't want to. And even though you might be comfortable with it, we have to remember that our audience volunteer is probably not comfortable with it, but also because of the pressure and apprehension of being on stage or being the audience spectator and they don't want to mess it up, they might oblige even though they are uncomfortable doing it. So it's really important that we start getting away from asking volunteers to do things like this. But I've seen this now in a couple of situations, and I'm not happy about it. So I wanted to definitely highlight it. One example is the challenge coin trick. I believe this is in the Mark Wilson Complete course. So it's pretty old. The challenge coin trick is where you take a coin and you either wrap it in the folds of the material of your pants near your pocket, or you place the coin in your actual pocket. The spectator is asked to touch the coin as the convincer to say, yes, I feel the coin. The coin is definitely still there. And then you either turn your pocket out or unfold the folds and the coin is gone, which means that the audience member actually touching the coin is incredibly important to the trick, which means they're made to feel like they don't have an option, which is bad news bears. Another one is, and this was brought to my attention recently, Exact Change by Gregory Wilson. In the discussion with Dan Harlan on Penguin, and I'll put a link to it, it's almost towards the end of the discussion. The quote Gregory Wilson says is, if you want to be cheeky, and I have no problem with this at all, have a girl go in and grab it. And the it is specifically the pocket change inside of the pocket. And although Gregory Wilson might not have a problem with a spectator going into his pocket and grabbing the change, she might. But also very specifically, he says, have a girl go in and grab it. Not have anybody that says, I'll do it. Have a girl go in, which once again alludes to the idea that your audience volunteer is a prop. This woman is a prop. A girl needs to do it because I don't want a guy anywhere near that part of my body. Which is one, homophobic, and two, sexist. So I think we need to put a squash on asking your audience volunteer to come anywhere near your front pants pocket. Of course, this could translate to a bajillion other things, but specifically, let's make this vanish, shall we? Yay! The Let's Make It Vanish segment is brought to you by the LA Collusion, a society of magicians of all backgrounds focused on improving the art of magic through culture, creativity, and communication. Link to the LA Collusion website is in the show notes.
So, hey, Felice.
Yes, Kayla.
You started this amazing show, Project Joy, called the Boston Magic Lab. Can you tell everyone how it started, where it was, and then we'll get into where it is now during a pandemic?
Yeah, it was inspired by the Toronto crew, by the newest trick in the book. I was friends with them because I performed there first at the newest trick in the book, performing my first indoor 20-minute act. And then when they were in town, they did the thing that connected magicians can do, which is call people to come and hang out. Yeah. And there were a whole bunch of magicians that I did not know about that were in the area. And we all met and hung out. And it was like, oh, hey, there's a community here. It was majority hobbyists and some professionals mixed in there, and different levels of semi to full-time professionals. And everyone was interested in doing some sort of public thing. And so I built the Boston Magic Lab pretty much 90% modeled off of the newest trick in the book. One big difference being that we're a monthly show instead of a weekly show. We found a really cool theater in Rossi Square. And after I found it and we started doing shows here, my goal was to try to build up diverse local talent So that meant, yes, all the performers that were there and just giving a platform for people to perform, because that didn't really exist unless you go out into the street, and that's really hard to do on your own. So I did want more and more people performing and just trying stuff out. That's why it's an open mic. Anyone can perform at least once if they want to. Timing is always hard just because we are a monthly show and we can only fit so many people in. There's a time limit, but it's fun. We have certain rules, which is that the show has to be inclusive to the audience and all the ways that it should be inclusive and friendly. It's not to be quote unquote PC and not to stop people from saying what they want to say, but it's so that the audience actually has fun.
Yeah.
And so when we were live in person, we only were able to have 2 women in out of 4 shows, right? December, January, February, March was our last one in person. We've existed longer virtually than we have in person. But the other really nice thing about the show that I'm trying to do is that you don't need to audition to get in. So it's building up new talent.
And a place to fail.
Yes.
To steal a phrase.
Yes. Which also means we get in our virtual shows a lot of younger magicians who are trying to start out, and they have a platform to try stuff. And I think that's one of the huge advantages of the Boston Magic Lab, at least virtually. I'm always very careful with Why Women Are Terrible episode, not to try and push people onto the stage before they're ready.
Yeah.
But the nature of the show means it's okay if you're not 100% comfortable yet. We want you to try.
That's so important to provide a space for people to fail. Reiterating what you said, Kate, is that that doesn't exist very often. And there's so much pressure on a lot of shows where you're like, I just want to try something new. So this is awesome. And now, obviously, since pandemic, you've moved to a monthly show online. After you have the learning curve of how to produce a good live show, boom, let's now go into a learning curve of learning a virtual live show. How did you go about learning how to produce this show? And what have you learned about producing shows virtually? What's been some of the hurdles you've had to jump over?
I think the first really, really big thing is we have a really good team. It's a team of all volunteers. And it is made up of the people that I met through Ventrin and Jonah Bevins from the Toronto Magic. I guess they have a podcast. I don't know, podcasts. But then apparently people listen to podcasts, I guess.
Please listen.
You know.
Sorry.
Please listen to my podcast.
I listen. But they're able to draw people because people listen to podcasts, I guess. I'm sorry. So one of the people in our production team, Colin Robinson, he was the one originally who wanted to start a virtual show. I really didn't want to. As someone whose majority of performances comes from interacting with the audience, I just, virtual shows. But he really wanted to try out stuff. And I think one really neat thing about jumping into the virtual platform was that our close-up performers were able to do stuff that they couldn't do in the parlor setting. So it was really fun to showcase that type of skill. After 4 months of in-person, that was much harder to showcase without a close-up camera. And so the Boston Magic Lab is the first open mic magic show. Okay, Toronto crew? We did ours first. First virtual one.
Virtual.
Yes.
Virtual. Advertising queue. It's escalating quickly.
That now they advertise themselves as the only open mic magic show virtually. So, exactly.
All right, we're calling Jonah. We're calling all of those guys.
They had one juggler on the Boston Magic Lab, and all of a sudden, they're not a magic show anymore.
Oh, such technicalities.
We keep it pretty straightforward in terms of our tech. Our very first show was a Zoom show that was live streamed to Facebook. At that time, we had a mix of live and pre-recorded. And that's really to try and bring in guest performers, especially international or like people who are too far away to be able to make it on time. And so all we did was screen share on Zoom. Now we use OBS at a very low level. I think the Boston Magic Lab as an open mic and as a free show, we can get away with our low tech. We're trying to improve it, but it's also a little part of our marketing, our vibe, is that we're very urban, we're not polished, which I think is okay. So just going slightly back in this weird winding explanation of what the Boston Magic Lab is, with the guest slots, we try our very best to bring in minority or diverse performers who are good. So like locally, it is an open mic. New England people, anyone who's interested can perform. Bring people in from other places, because there are so few minorities in magic, we want the minorities who come in to not be the example of the only bad woman magician who will represent all women.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's important to us. And then the other thing we try to do is not make a big deal of the diversity that is in our show. We've noticed it in the comments. I think they're from people who know magic or have watched a lot of magic. I think we had one show that was gender split at least 50-50. And we're trying to do a little bit better with race, but it's still hard. But internationally, like, if you have access to everyone in the world, why is your cast still all white men?
Yeah. Thank you.
If you are doing a Zoom show with access to the world, why is it all the same kinds of people?
Yeah.
Why not try? It's knacky.
It's just so knacky to book diversity.
Doing a diverse show is knacky.
So knacky.
Just have to keep working just on practice. It and then it clicks.
It'll be fine. God, I love it so much. Yeah, it was so much fun. The Magic Lab show is such a great time. I mean, I just did it for the first time and I watched a couple during the pandemic fun. And it's just so fun because there is no pressure in a sense. I felt really cared for and safe as a performer. So that means that that's good on your team for making a good place for performers to be okay with not doing great. Also, if I may add, is that you have a feedback session.
Oh, yes. Yes, right. The Saturday after the show, we have a performer workshop session. Originally, it was just a post-show jam. And then we were like, hey, let's try and find a way to make this more productive and more useful for the performers. And so since we don't and we can't pay our performers, we try and find some other way to give back if they're interested. And so we were really excited that you were able to join that.
That was great. Working with both of you was really fun, which obviously led to this episode, but it was really cool to, as I talk about many times in this podcast, I think everyone should love feedback, which also means everyone should love getting negative feedback, which is just part of the game because you should love being good and never stop trying. And so I loved that. I didn't even know that when you asked me to do the show. And then all of a sudden I was like, there's feedback? Oh my goodness. And it was so great.
Can I give a shout out?
Yes.
Huge shout out to Colin Robinson, who facilitates those feedback sessions.
And so well.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. He's very good at it. Whenever he can't make it, I'm like, no, I had to run this.
It's so cool. Oh my goodness. It was so much fun. It's such a great thing. Everyone should go watch it. It's on Facebook. Go watch the shows. They're great.
The whole show is more than a show. And I think the reason, I'm just going to interject my opinions on the Magic Lab. The reason that the show works so well, even as a virtual show, is because it's the Boston Magic Lab community, the people who put it together and the people who watch and the people who have watched it when it was live come together and they are part of this thing that's happening. So yeah, the aesthetics aren't as polished as a high-tech professional show, but you feel like you're seeing something that people care about put together.
Big time.
That comes through on every level.
Our marketing goes towards JP and Boston social groups, Boston meetups, Rosie Square Theater, that area. So like, even though we're virtual, we're still trying to market to a local audience.
That's so great. All right. So going into our lightning round, as you know, the lightning round is meant to be just fun and cool and slightly informative, but also just silly gooseness so that we can end on the most positive note possible. So you can answer these as short as you'd like or max maven it and answer 2 hours per question. Oh, yes, I'm glad
you left. Looks so tense, Felice.
Felice, these are all going to you. So you can both answer each question. Ready? Take a breath. They're very easy. Question number one. What is your go-to resource for learning more about street performing?
Other street performers.
I was about to say tape, but also I didn't want to.
I am another street performer. Ego. Like so. I am a street performer. My ego is massive. So it's fine on all counts. I still fall under the other street performer count. And also, okay. Thank you.
Also other street magicians, which are really hard to find ones in the U.S. usually. I find the international street magic scene to be really, really inspiring and educational.
Cool, ooh, yeah.
Can I make a digression?
It's a lightning round.
I don't care.
Lightning.
Ugh, I hate from Florida. I should know about lightning. It's just harder to find magicians. It's harder to find magicians because you can work more places. The Circle Show congregate in a few places because it's all the places that we can work without being arrested. You have your little magic kit. You could just pick it up and run.
Good point. Really good
magicians,
point.
Magicians, learn to run.
Oh, that's a whole other episode, isn't it? Oh, <yeah. laughs> What's the worst hat line you've ever heard?
Oh, God. I once saw this one kid. This is not a hat line. It's a finale, but it's lightning round. I don't care. This one kid was so pissed at his audience. He only had 7 people. He didn't do his finale, was not a flip, but he told them all he was going to do a flip, and he called each person out of the audience into a line, had them stand real close together, squish, bend over, started walking back as though he was about to do a flip over all of them, and just left.
That's awesome. I'm so happy. Felice.
I can't think of anything else. It's the worst hat line I've ever heard. I think usually when someone struggles with a hat line, they end up not saying one.
Yeah, that's what usually happens. You go, thanks, give me money. And then they don't.
Rob Belchunas also asked, what's your favorite pitch ever?
I'm telling you.
No. Bye.
So that is a thing in the street performing world. If we tell you where it is, then you will go there. And it's my pitch.
You have your secrets and so do we.
That's cool. Okay, next moving question. On. That's cool. I didn't know that was going to be the answer. I was so confused.
Some of this you have to learn yourself.
That's awesome.
You have to at least show us that you're trying before we trust you.
That's fun. Okay, what if I change it slightly to say, what's your favorite festival?
I've only worked one actual Busker Fest, and that one was my favorite one so far, which is Lawrence Busker Fest in Kansas.
Also my favorite because they love me there. That was my first Hatting Busker Festival. They hired me for the first time in 2011, and they've had me back 5 times. It was their 4th festival that they had ever put on, and it was my first one in the U.S. where I was asking for a hat. And so the festival and I have grown up together, and they've put me on the poster 2x. And every time I go back there, they are excited to see me, and it makes me feel very good about myself.
I love that. Wayne Moulton asked, what's the weirdest thing you've ever had to deal with while street performing?
This is the worst thing. There's these guys in the front row of my audience on a good day, huge crowd, doing great. And these dudes were like, hey, it's the 1970s, wide collars, big chain, like whatever. They had fucking a little Bluetooth speaker with them. And at a certain point, they started playing music in my show. And I was like, dudes, what are you doing? So we had a little conversation. Whatever. Eventually, the crowd is on my side. This is the key with hecklers, by the way. If you have the power, you can shut down the heckler. If you don't have the power, then you're screwed. They're going to shut you down. So have the audience on your side. Anyway, later, turns out these two dudes tried to kidnap a girl just around the corner from my show. They like apparently tried to buy this girl from her parents unsolicited. Sorry, this is taking a real dark turn. And then they tried to kidnap her. And it's like, yeah. So all kinds of weird stuff. We could cut the story there, and I could tell a more lighthearted story when somebody shoplifted from someone else.
No, the kidnapping story is ideal. Felice, do you have one?
I've got weird tips before. I've got tip, a little white pill for concentration. Like, what was it? It's one of those.
Like a Xanax? No, that's not it.
Yeah,
one of those. Adderall.
I didn't know what it was, but yes. And then I got asked if I accepted Bud, and I asked what was that, and then they left.
That's so adorable. That's awesome. That I would have also asked that question, because up until like a year ago, I had no idea what that was either, so that's great. Big dogs or little dogs? You could also answer cats, but I'll judge you.
Little dogs, but only because I'm a little bit afraid of the big dogs when they come close. Sometimes. It depends if they're nice. If they're nice, it's okay.
That's how I feel about people.
Controversial answer, no dogs or animals. Okay. I just like to see them in nature. I don't want to touch their poop. Just let an animal be an animal. I know. I understand the look that you're giving me, and I get it, and I understand, and I appreciate your perspective, but also I don't want to own an animal. I knew what I was getting into. I know what I said.
All right, you can stay in the episode. If you could only eat one dessert for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Brownies.
Cookies. That's the one. That was too much pressure. That was very difficult.
That was the hard question.
It was. I love so many desserts. Cookies and cheesecakes. It was very close. Ooh, very close.
You can have both. Where can people find you to find out more and keep in touch or ask questions or whatever you decide is the kind of contact you want?
Just not Felice. JustFelice.
Instagram at KGreatShow if you want to see mostly juggling tricks with some performance stuff mixed in there. And also KGreat.com and Facebook/KGreat. And that's Kate with a C because I am complicated.
There's very little of me performing online anywhere, like saved anywhere. Sorry.
Surprise, please.
Surprise, please. I do have like a unlisted YouTube videos, but it's unlisted, so you can't find them. And the one that you can't find, Bill McQuirk, because that's me in a straitjacket rolling around in the ground somewhere.
At least like the best way to contact me is don't. Yeah. Justfelice.com.
Watch me live. Live shows when we're in person again, because virtual shows are hard.
And everyone check out the Boston Magic Lab, please. Boom. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
We did it.
Yay.
This is so fun.
It's so hard.
Yeah.
It was so hard. Oh my
goodness. What are the rules?
And that's the episode. Don't forget to follow us on the socials at SheZamPod. For all things swag, head over to our website at shezampod.com for shirts, pins, and that coveted Don't Touch Me skateboard. You know you need it. If you are interested in the bonus content for this episode and future episodes, plus exclusive swag designs, behind-the-scenes content, and shout-outs in episodes, become a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/shezampod. Links to everything are in our show notes. You can also sponsor one of our many segments this season. I still have some spots left, so please email me at shezampod@gmail.com if you'd like to find out more. Shazam is sponsored in part by the International Brotherhood of Magicians and the Society of American Magicians. Thank you to the IBM and the SAM for your support. Our audio producer is Chris Combs. The Shazam theme song is recorded and produced by Kevin Karikas with vocals by Jonah Fagel. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you soon. Bye.